We're going through this monster Maldacena calculation. Last time we wrote the action for single field slow roll inflation in ADM variables. So everything is in a sort of 3 plus 1 dimensional notation where time derivatives are not covariant, and it denoted explicitly with dots, and all the geometric notation here is with respect to the 3-metric HIJ. The raising and lowering of indices is done with the 3-metric, not the 4-metric. The covariant derivatives are covariant derivatives with respect to the 3-metric. This curvature R3 is, I preserve the 3 superscript to remind you that it's not the curvature of the ambient 4-metric. We argued that we can choose this gauge. This is Maldacena's gauge, in which fluctuations, time reparameterizations have been used to gauge away fluctuations in the phi field. Surfaces of constant time coincide with surfaces of constant phi. And then the metric can be put in this form, where this form plus the first line here just define the fields zeta and gamma. You can just take any traceless symmetric 2-tensor in 3 dimensions, pull out its determinant, call that zeta, or rather e to the 2 zeta is the determinant, plus e to a traceless matrix. And then the gauge condition is that the derivative of that, suitably contracted to get a 3 vector, is 0. So that's setting 1-3 vector to 0, so it's using up the spatial reparameterization symmetry. In this gauge, if there are some simplifications here. This term becomes, the spatial derivatives of phi are 0, so this term just becomes n inverse phi dot squared, and this term becomes 0. Now the next step in the calculation is to remove non-dynamical degrees of freedom. What's nice about the ADM formalism is that it's sort of organizing things. If you want to define variables, like this is really convenient if you want to numerically evolve general relativity. If you want to define degrees of freedom on 3-dimensional surfaces and evolve things forward in time, the ADM formalism organizes things so that you can see which quantities are dynamical variables and which are not. The fields n and ni are non-dynamical. Time derivatives of these fields don't appear in the action. Spatial derivatives do. They're hidden in the E. That means that their equations of motion don't contain time derivatives either, i.e., the equations of motion for the n and ni fields are just algebraic equations that tell you how to solve for n and ni in terms of h, which is the actual dynamical quantity. So in the next step, we're going to... So general relativity looks like it has 10 dynamical degrees of freedom, but secretly there are only 6. That's what the ADM formalism brings out, makes explicit. In the next step, we're going to remove these non-dynamical degrees of freedom. So we're actually going to solve for n and ni and plug them back into the action to get an action with fewer degrees of freedom. By the way, the choice of gauge has also removed some degrees of freedom from the problem. It removed phi. Now where phi appears in the action, it just means the zeroth order background solution, i.e. some time-dependent function, some function of t, that's fixed ahead of time and doesn't have fluctuations associated with it. So we could take the phi out here. And the gauge condition is also reduce the number of degrees of freedom in the metric hij, rather than being a quantity with 6 degrees of freedom. 3 of those degrees of freedom have been removed by the reparameterization invariants, leaving the subject zeta, which has 1 degree of freedom, and the subject gamma, which has 2 degrees of freedom per Fourier mode, the traceless symmetric, the traceless transverse modes. Let me write the equations of motion for n and ni. So varying the section with respect to n is straightforward. Varying the action with respect to ni, there are derivative terms. Now, normally what happens, if you vary an action, say in classical mechanics, you vary an action that contains a kinetic term like 1/2 pi dot squared. That gives you, so when I vary this, well, when I vary this, I get, let me start in a different place. In classical field theory, suppose I have a term in the action, so there's no metric here. So in, say, the theory of a free scalar field on Minkowski, if I have a term in the action like this, say, so with no metric, when I vary it with respect to to phi in the equations of motion, what I end up getting out is minus del I phi. And that happens minus 2. Where the minus sign is because of integration by parts, I get the gradient of delta phi, and then I integrate by parts to put the derivative on the other phi to get something proportional to delta phi. The way this works in GR, if I have a term in the action like d3x square root h, the point I'm trying to make is that in GR, if you're varying a term in the action like this, you just do kind of the naive thing where you ignore the root h and replace covariant derivatives, replace ordinary partial derivatives by covariant ones. In other words, if I have a term like this in the action, and I vary with respect to phi, this equation would make more sense if I had delta phi at the end of it. I just get the covariant Laplacian here with a minus 2. And the reason that's true is because the way integration by parts works in GR is that, so you might think when you vary this that you have terms where the spatial derivatives act on the root h, or maybe the hij. That appears when I that's really included in this contraction. The reason you don't get those terms is that the way integration by parts works in general relativity tells you to ignore those terms. If I were to just integrate this, if I wanted to integrate by parts in this expression to put the del I here, what differential geometry tells me to do is just move the covariant derivative from here to here with a minus sign, ignoring the root h. So anyway, with that little covariant derivative subtlety aside, it's straightforward to vary this action with respect to ni and get this. Now I'm interested eventually in just expanding this action to third order in the fluctuations. Maldacena points out that in order to expand the action to third order in fluctuations, it suffices to solve the constraints at linear order, at first order in the fluctuations. Suffices to determine n and ni. So this is a pair of nonlinear equations that you could solve for n and ni in terms of h. Interestingly, it suffices to solve these to first order in the dynamical variables, i.e. zeta and gamma. And the reason that's true is because, so generally if I had some formula involving n's and I wanted to solve the constraints and plug them in and get that quantity to third order in the fluctuations, of course I would need to know n and ni to third order. But the action is special because when you vary it, you always get the equations of motion. So suppose that I have solved the constraints to first order. So you could imagine that the action is some function of, if I fix a field configuration of zeta and gamma, then the action is some function of n and I. So suppose that I'm sitting at the point where the constraints are solved to first order. The equations of motion for n and ni are satisfied to first order. If I then shift n and ni by some second order amount, then the action will change by its derivative, schematically, its derivative with respect to, functional derivative with respect to the n and ni fields times their variations. Now the point is that I'm already sitting at a configuration where the equations of motion are satisfied to first order, which means that these terms are second order in the fluctuations. And so if I shift n and ni by a further second order amount, the action only shifts to at fourth order. So that's a nice simplification. That's actually gonna simplify things a lot. So I'm just gonna end up, when I solve the constraints, I'm gonna end up with some formulas where I just have n and ni, you know, like some matrix where the matrix can involve derivative operators, spatial derivative operators and functions of time, but no dynamical fields times zeta gamma. Simplification number two, and this is only true because I am working in linear perturbation theory. You know, in other words, for the purpose of this calculation, I can work in linear perturbation theory. So at linear level, I can assume gamma equals zero. In other words, there aren't going to be non-zero entries here in the matrix. And I can assume that my final expression for ni is going to be the gradient of some quantity psi. Why is this? Someone tell me why these statements are true.
Second one's probably because you can't have dynamical vectors in homogeneous expanding vector. And GR has no dynamical vectors. So whatever that should be some kind of gradient, something that's exact, something that's a scalar.
I would say those statements are true for the same reason. There's a symmetry reason why both of those statements are true. You know, sort of a direct argument is that in linear theory, so rotation invariance of the background is only being broken by these gamma and delta fields. These are fluctuations around a homogeneous background. And so you can just imagine, well, how could I get to lowest order some fluctuation in n out of these fields? So n is a scalar. This is a scalar, and this is a tensor. So there's no problem putting some function of time or some operator times zeta. But when gamma comes along, you know, I'm going to have to get rid of these indices somehow to end up with a scalar on this side. And the only way to do that is with like derivative operators. The only way to do that in linear theory is with derivative operators. You could imagine, you know, one way to say it is that in Fourier space, you know, if this is all at some wave vector k, the only vector around that's breaking the symmetry is the vector k itself. So I could put k's here, but there's just nothing else around to contract with. And this type of term is zero by the gauge condition. I just chose a gauge where those derivatives are zero. Another way of phrasing the symmetry argument is that in linear theory, I can think one k mode at a time. And I've just chosen a gauge where the Fourier modes of gamma only have traceless transverse degrees of freedom. So if I rotate around the Fourier wave vector k, I only get components with helicity plus or minus 2. And so there's just no way to couple those modes to a scalar, which has helicity 0. That's actually the argument for the second part here. No, sorry, the first part. When I go to ni, you know, the only possibilities are I can couple to zeta with a derivative operator. The only possibility is consistent with symmetry. I can couple to zeta with a derivative operator. And then if I try to couple to gamma, then I need one derivative operator to get rid of the index, and that's zero by the gauge condition. In this language, what's happening is that n is just a general, at a given Fourier mode, n has a helicity zero component, the component of ni that points in the direction of the Fourier mode, and two transverse helicity plus or minus one components. These guys can't couple to either zeta or gamma, which have helicity zero or plus or minus two, respectively, which tells you that ni has to point in the direction of k, which is a way of saying in Fourier space that it's the gradient of some field. Okay, so that's going to simplify things. One lesson I keep learning the hard way is that it's always very powerful to just have symmetry in the back of your mind and think about all ways, as you go along and do a calculation, all ways that symmetry might simplify the algebra. Okay, so what these simplifications mean is that I'm trying to solve these constraints, linearize and solve these constraints in a situation where the metric doesn't have the gamma term. N is 1 plus, I'm going to linearize everything. So zeta here is a, you know, a first order quantity. Delta N is a first order quantity. And Ni is the gradient of some scalar psi, which is first order. So now if I start, now let me start linearizing these equations. So Eij looks like this. When I compute hij dot, well, the time derivative acts on the a and the zeta. When it acts on the a, it just brings down an h. Sorry, it's 2h because of the square. So the derivative of a is, the time derivative of a is ah, and so when you differentiate here, you just get 2h times the metric hij. When I take the derivative with respect to zeta, I get 2 zeta dot times a squared delta ij. This is not, these two expressions differ at higher order in zeta, but I'm not keeping track of those terms. Minus, because my ni is the derivative of a scalar, these two terms are the same. One comment on notation is that I found it convenient when going through these low-order perturbation theory calculation to just always use covariant derivatives and covariant notation in the spatial directions, which means that some of these terms are hiding terms that are higher order in the fluctuations. For example, the HHIJ is hiding a term which is first order in zeta. Okay, and then E, if I trace this to get E, I get 3H. When I trace the metric H, I always get 3 plus 3 zeta dot minus del squared sine. By the way, my notation is that when del squared of a field is always its covariant Laplacian, and when I write grad square, of course, I always mean the covariant gradient squared. Okay. So the second equation of motion. So the second equation. Now that I've found E to linear order, I can solve the second constraint equation to linear order. So if I plug in these fluctuations in the second equation of motion and just expand out to linear order, I won't go through the whole chain of equations, but after some work, some straightforward steps, you write the second equation of motion as
zeta, are you implicitly assuming that you have some kind of exponential sort of ancestors that you're expanding? Because at first order, that's going to be 2 zeta dot a squared delta, which is not the same as...
Oh, yeah, you know, I could have actually... I'm expanding... Yeah, that is true, actually. It would have been a little bit better. I'm only keeping track of things to first order and zeta, so I was, like, you know, a little sloppy here. But I guess it would have been a little more precise to write it, the metric as a squared e to the 2 zeta. And then this expression for eij is true at all orders. That's right. Okay. So the second equation of motion, if you plug in these expressions for e and linearize in n, in delta n, you get this equals 0. And now the only way that this can be true, you know, canceling out the coefficients of the hij here have to be the same, is if delta n is equal to zeta dot over h. So I've solved half the constraints. The first equation of motion. Contains the scalar 3 curvature. And so I need to compute the scalar curvature for this metric hij. Of course, I only need to compute it to lowest order in zeta. This metric is flat if zeta equals 0, so it'll just be some term that's first order in zeta here. Of course, one way to do it to linear order, it's easy enough to just run the GR machine, calculate the Christoffel symbols for this metric, contract them and multiply them to get the Ricci tensor, contract to get the Ricci scalar. That's easy enough. It totally works. But there's another method that would work here, which is going to be useful because we'll soon need to do similar calculations to higher order and perturbation theory, where the brute force approach would be a mess. So just for fun, does anyone there's nothing wrong with the brute force approach here. We're just going to linear order. But if you wanted to do it in a different way, does anyone have a suggestion? The different way is actually just a way of recognizing that the answer that you're looking for is already in like an appendix of Wald. There's just a standard set of formulas that you can appeal to. And that is... So this metric is, exactly. It's conformally flat. I just multiplied a simple metric, delta ij, by a scalar function without any indices. In other words, my metric is conformally related by a scalar function to a simple metric. And in that situation, so there's a whole bunch of formulas in general relativity that tell you when you conformally scale a metric, multiply it by a function of space and time, how various quantities like the curvature change. So I opened up appendix D of Wald and found the following formulas. So if I have two metrics, let me call them eta, which are related This is true in any number of dimensions, and the dimensions can be space-like or time-like. So in D space-time dimensions, it's generally true, and these equations are true to all orders in omega, that the scalar curvatures of these metrics are related by, so here's one formula. When you have two metrics, it's easy to get confused when you raise and lower indices, for example, because you can raise or lower with either metric. So I'm actually writing the raising operations explicitly here. So this line gives you R bar in terms of quantities that are just associated with the unbarred metric. And then there's, if you want a right-hand side that has barred stuff, then you can, there's a slightly different formula for that, in which almost the same formula. The sign is flipped, and the e to the minus 2 omega just multiplies the curvature, not the other terms. So we're going to use these. It's generally useful with doing all sorts of calculations to have a little alarm bell that goes off in your head. When you see some metric multiplied by a scalar function, you can appeal to these formulas. Okay, so if I apply these formulas to I want to compute R3. With an unbarred metric equal to, let's equal to say A squared delta IJ. Barred metric equal to A squared e to the 2 zeta delta IJ. Then I can read off the scalar curvature. Let me, I want to use, well, actually, it doesn't matter at this order in perturbation theory whether I'm using barred or unbarred covariant derivatives. So I guess I'll just write the last. So R3 is, let me use the expression in the second line. Is e to the minus 2 zeta times 0 minus 2, I'm in three dimensions, times the barred metric, which is hij. Oh, I forgot the omega here. Minus 2 hij times derivative I, derivative j, zeta, plus another term which is order zeta squared. Sorry, this coefficient should have been 4. So the scalar curvature is just minus 4 times the covariant Laplacian of zeta, to first order in zeta. Okay. Now, I'm going to skip some steps. We already have expressions for ij and e to first order in the fluctuations. We have an expression for R3. So let me just skip the algebra where we plug all that in and end up with the linearized version of this first equation of motion and just write out the answer. Okay, so it's easy to check that if you plug in, you can write the result like this. So this actually contains, due to the phi dot squared and v and so on, some expressions that are, and the e, a piece which is zeroth order in the fluctuations, plus a piece which is first order. So here's what you get if you just expand linearize mechanically. Now this term, the zeroth order term, had better be zero, and indeed that's true. This is true on the background equation of motion by Friedman's equation. I can rewrite this as, so Friedman's equation tells you that h squared generally is rho over 3 in Planck units. In non-Planck units, it would be 8 pi g over 3. 3 rho. No, rho over 3. Which the scalar field in FRW with no fluctuations, the energy density is just 1/2 phi dot squared plus v, and that's why this cancels. Because the background solution is supposed to satisfy all the equations of motion and minimize the action, there would be something wrong if we were finding something non-zero here. Then plugging in, I did do one thing slightly non-trivial. I did do one thing in the step. I plugged in the delta n equal to zeta dot over h that we got before. Okay, so solving this equation for psi, you can write psi in this sort of weird form. Minus theta over h plus phi dot squared over 2h squared times Laplacian to the minus 2 of zeta dot. Laplacian to the minus 2 is a well-defined operator. You can write it down with Green's functions. Of course, I mean the inverse of the covariant Laplacian. So because the covariant Laplacian hides a factor of a to the minus 2, for example, the inverse Laplacian hides a factor of a squared. Okay. So now I've argued that it suffices to solve the constraints at linear order. I've done that, so I can plug back into the action to get an expression for the action in terms of zeta and gamma, no n's, which is going to be the starting point for, there's a root h. So I finally succeeded in identifying, after choosing a gauge and removing non-dynamical quantities, what the basic degrees of freedom are, the scalar and this traceless symmetric tensor, and what their action is. So just to write down a few more formulas here just to make sure everything is self-contained, put everything in one place. The metric is given in terms of these variables by this. Eij by this. Where psi is, I'm going to leave psi in. You should also remember that, you know, phi dot v h, these are just, the fluctuations have been gauged away in phi, so these are just fixed functions of time that satisfy the background equations of motion. Okay, so let's take this action and try to expand it to second order in the fluctuation fields zeta and gamma to find the free theory, and then to third order to get a look at the interactions. Okay, so we want to expand to expand this action to second order in zeta and gamma, and third order in zeta. Maldesane in his paper computes all the third order terms, but for purposes of comparing with observations, we're really just interested in non-Gaussianity in the scalar sector, so it will suffice observationally to calculate this term. This is probably the only term that I'll, I might discuss Maldesane's calculation of the other terms, but this is probably the only interaction that I'll discuss. So there are no terms linear in zeta or gamma. Why is that?
And also, it's inconsistent for symmetries to have a term which is just linear.
You couldn't have a term linear in gamma by symmetry, but symmetry does allow a term linear in zeta, right?
Linear scalar is like a black hole. Just to appeal to definition. Could absorb
the the answer I was looking for is that, you know, because the background satisfies the equations of motion.
Then you won't see a term in the action that's linear in the fluctuations around the equations of motion. Otherwise, you know, you would not,
the functional derivative of the action with respect to the fluctuations would not be zero at zero fluctuation. Okay. We can also use symmetry to constrain the form of the quadratic piece. So at quadratic order, what's the most general action one can write down in terms of this scalar zeta and this traceless symmetric, this traceless transverse tensor gamma? So so it. Quadratic order, working to quadratic order in the action is sort of morally equivalent to thinking about the equations of motion at linear level. A little thinking about symmetry shows you, and I'm writing this down in Fourier space. Shows you that the most general thing you can have is this. I can couple the scalar to itself in sort of an arbitrary way where the coefficient can have k dependence and time dependence. But I can't couple, I can't write down a rotation invariant quadratic action that couples zeta to gamma because, you know, there's this, at a given Fourier mode k, the only vector around to absorb these indices would be k itself, and this combination vanishes by the gauge condition. And likewise, when I contract, so I can't mix zeta and a gamma. And likewise, if I try to mix two zetas, well, I need a scalar, so I need to eat up these indices. Contracting with a k always gives me zero by the gauge condition. If I had a, so I could, the only object, other object around is delta, and I can't put in a delta ij by the gauge condition. I can't contract two indices on the same gamma with each other. That gives zero by the gauge condition. And so the only thing I can do is contract an index in one gamma with an index in the other gamma. And it doesn't matter how I permute here, because gamma itself is symmetric. So this is the only coupling that's possible. And the coefficient of that coupling can depend on k and t. It could be different. You know, all the Fourier modes are different, so it could be different for each Fourier mode. But that's the only choice. You could also think about symmetry here. If I have a Fourier mode k, then zeta has helicity 0. Zeta k is invariant if I rotate around, if I rotate the universe around this Fourier mode. Gamma ij has components of helicity plus or minus 2. So I can couple the plus 2 to the minus 2 and get something with helicity 0. And that coupling has to be the same as, by parity invariance, the coupling between the minus 2 helicity mode and the helicity plus 2 mode. If you follow that argument, that's sort of a sketch. But if you follow that argument, you'll write down the same form. Okay. So how does this expression help? For one thing, it shows that, so this term is gone. For one thing, it shows that I can do this calculation in two pieces. One piece where I set, so if I'm just interested in calculating these terms, I can first calculate the action. I can calculate S setting zeta to 0. And calculating, expanding in gamma to second order. And then I can just start over with a new calculation where I set gamma equals 0 and calculate the action to third order in zeta. Let's start with this piece. One sec. The q's.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I mean. You know, that's exactly what we're going to calculate. Okay. So we're setting zeta equals 0, so we're assuming that the metric is this. And the first thing we need to know is the in this action is the scalar curvature. So I kind of flailed around on this when I tried to calculate it. So it's a very straightforwardly posed question. You have this metric to second order in gamma, what's the scalar curvature? If you actually start doing it by brute force with the Christoffel symbols and the Riemann tensor, the algebra was a little too much for my taste. After a while, I noticed this little trick, which I thought was sort of entertaining. So you'll remember that, you'll recall from general relativity that, recall the way the Einstein equations of motion are derived from the Einstein-Hilbert action. There's a calculation, we're going to sort of leverage this calculation, that if I take the functional derivative, if I differentiate the Einstein-Hilbert action, let me put this R3 to emphasize that this is in 3 plus 0 dimensions, then I get the Einstein tensor. So this is the way this formula is usually written in the books is Gij delta Gi delta H Ij. So if I knew the scalar curvature in terms of gamma, then if I differentiated with respect to gamma, I should just get the Einstein tensor. And so that means that there's one derivative, the scalar curvature to second order in gamma is determined by the Einstein tensor to first order in gamma. So let's figure out how to use that. So first, the first thing that I did, that's the idea of the trick, to make it work technically. The first thing that I did is I calculated the Einstein tensor to first order in gamma for this metric. That's a very straightforward calculation going through the Christoffel symbols, the Ricci tensor. Let me just tell you what you get. You get minus 1/2 delta KL del K del L gamma IJ.
Sorry?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have too many deltas here. Thanks. This should just be delta KL. Thanks. Okay. Now, if you write out to show how, so this is to first order in gamma. To show how the Einstein tensor at first order in gamma determines the scalar curvature at second order in gamma, let's write out both sides of this expression. So on the left-hand side, let me choose the following notation. We know by symmetry that the left-hand side here in Fourier space is going to be given by, my notes here are sort of incomprehensible even to me. Let's see if this works. I know that the right-hand side, left-hand side, has to look like this. For some choice of coefficient QR, which is what I'm trying to determine, if I vary the right-hand side with respect to the metric, so let's vary both sides, plus terms of order gamma cubed. By the way, the terms of order gamma cubed are much less constrained by symmetry than the terms of order gamma squared. It's a bit harder to write down an expression like this. Let's see. So I'll get, now you have to be a little careful here. We want to express the final, that's fine. So if I vary this with respect to, gamma, then I'll get this. That's the left-hand side. Times delta gamma KL, okay? No 1/2. And on the right-hand side, I can put in I'll put in my calculation of the Einstein tensor here. So let me first write it as Gij. Let's first write the right-hand side as Gij star in Fourier space, delta Hij. Okay. H upper ij, if I invert, I get an a of t to the minus 2. And this coefficient switches sign. Let's, to be really like anal retentive about, notation, I'm always, I always write the deltas explicitly when I use them to raise and lower indices. I'm gonna always keep lower indices on gamma. The point is that if I vary this expression with respect to gamma, delta Hij is minus a to the minus 2 times delta gamma. Whereas if I needed delta H lower ij, it would be a squared delta gamma ij. Things can get confusing, just like things can get confusing with multiple metrics. Notation can get confusing when you're varying one metric. You might get confused and think that this is given by this with the indices raised, but that's not true. There's a minus sign. So writing out the right-hand side here. I get, so for the Gij, get minus 1/2. So in Fourier space, each derivative converts to an ik, so the I squared cancels the minus sign, and I get plus 1/2 delta KL KL gamma star. This delta ij in terms of this delta in terms of delta gamma lower KL is minus a to the minus 2 delta ik delta jl delta KL of K. Now by comparing the coefficient of gamma delta gamma on both sides. I can find the QR, which is what I need to determine R3 to second order. So looks like I'm going to get minus QR equal to minus AK squared over 4. So that gives me the first piece in the action. This guy is equal to 1/2 in Fourier space. You could also write this covariantly, going back to real space. There's a 1/8 minus 1/8 okay, so I guess next time things really go slow if you do all the steps on the board, but I don't want to shortcut things too much. Next time we'll finish the gravity wave part of the calculation and talk about the scalar part.
General, if I just have two k's and I have some tensors on the right, and I'm doing this reverse Fourier transform, how do I know how the derivatives will contract indices of the, or how the derivatives will act on the tensors? Because a priori, you could think of many other ways that could happen, which is consistent with the symmetries.
I think you're asking about this object, right? Why does that have this?
No, I mean there. So when you go from a k squared over 4 times all that to the two derivatives of gamma, is that the only combination of derivatives of gamma that survives under, by the gauge condition, or? Because a priori, I can see other ways in which you can contract indices and multiply those things to form terms that are still.
That's absolutely right. So I think you are asking about this tensor structure, right?
Exactly.
Right? Why I didn't have something more general here?
Right. I mean, or how that translates into that particular form. Is that one to one, or is there more than one way?
Maybe it would have been better to write this as. Maybe it would have been more transparent to write this as case. Squared. This is right. Let me put it back. Let me just think about what you're asking. This is, let me write this out explicitly as like Km, Kn, delta Mn. Okay. Yeah. This is what you get when you go from this expression in Fourier space to real space.